cold. It is cold. Temperatures are only in the 20s, low end. It's windy. It's snow. Big change starting tomorrow. And over the weekend, you'll want to get out the grill because they're not calling for temperatures near 60 on both Saturday and Sunday. Good. Good. We have a good program coming up for you today. Several guests are here. We've had a lot of great guests this week. A little bit later on the program, we're going to be talking about narcissism. Narcissism. People who think they're better than everybody else. Can you think of anyone right now who feels that way? Actually, I'm joking a little bit. Our guest, Dr. Craig Malkin, says, yes, political candidates tend to be narcissists. And he says almost all presidents are narcissists. So don't be pointing the finger just at Donald Trump. And by the way, and the reason that Dr. Malkin is kind of intriguing, he says there's good things about being a narcissist as well. You know what it is, by the way, right? Narcissism, we'll talk about that too. Coming up later on the program, and also today we'll be chatting. We begin the first of a series of programs over the next couple of days dealing with the opioid crisis here in our area. You know, they've had two forums already on the opioid crisis. There was one last October at Butler Intermediate High School, huge crowd. They had another one later in the year, it was December, I think, at Morris High School. Now, there's one next week at Slippery Rock Area High School. And in advance of that, we're going to be talking with some folks about the crisis, looking at it from a variety of different angles. This afternoon, we'll look at it from the law enforcement side with County Detective Mark Peffer joining us. That'll be at 1:30 today. All of that to come later. Our first guests are with us here in the studio right now. John Gibson is here representing the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. John, always good to look across the console and see you over there. Good to see
always,
you, my friend.
Always great to see you, Dave, and thanks so much for having us down here today. When I say us, I mean the Society of St. Vincent de Paul.
Great organization. Also with us is General Manager of Butler Radio, and that's Vicki Hinderberger. Vicki, good to see you, too.
Good afternoon, Dave. Thank you.
There is an event coming up that WISR is sponsoring. It's actually the end of next week.
Yes.
And one of the beneficiaries of the event is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, which we want to talk about with John. But fill our listeners in on the event, first of all.
Sure, Dave. One of the things that both you and I historically have done is be very involved in the community. And as a community steward, we have over the years created promotions and different initiatives to help improve the quality of life in our community. And I know you believe this as well, that we're all better when we work together for the common good. The new event we're coordinating is entitled Men Who Cook, which is a very different angle for something here in our market. It's not the usual golf or dinner type of thing, but it's Men Who Cook, and I'm pleased to announce that Armstrong is partnering with us, and kind of ties together too because it ties in their Breaking Bread initiative.
Yeah.
But Men Who Cook is something where we've approached local community leaders, again, the community initiative portion, and invited them to come cook their favorite dish or something that they enjoy making. And I'm pleased to report that on Saturday, February 25th, we have over 23 different community men, male participants, cooking for us. And it's going to be so much fun. February is celebrated nationally as Heart Month, and heart disease is number one killer of American men and women. So the fundraising will benefit not only the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, but also the American Heart Association Heart Walk. So it kind of helps us in two different areas of our community where a need is felt. So.
And that is, it's not this Saturday, but it's a week from Saturday.
Right, Saturday, February 25th at 6 p.m. at General Butler Vagabonds in Lindora. Tickets are just $20, and you're going to get to sample a wide variety. We'll let John talk about St. Vincent de Paul, and then I'll elaborate a little bit more about some of the other items that we're going to be having that evening.
Yeah, those attending, first of all, you can get samples of all the dishes that are being prepared by the Men Who Cook.
Yes.
Men Who Cook, and then after that, that runs. That's the first half of the evening, and then there's a dance.
Right.
It's a dinner dance.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. John, you've been involved with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler for a long, long time. I've known about it. I really have learned a lot about it, though, from you and a couple of other veteran volunteers, certainly Nick and some other folks. And everybody that I know of who works with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul and who volunteers time says it's nothing. I get more back from this than I give.
I agree with that statement 100%. In fact, I was saying last night we had our district council meeting, and it was down at St. Killian's Parish. I was telling my fellow Vincentians that I almost feel selfish about what I do with St. Vincent de Paul because of the feeling I get by being able to help others either through the food bank or through our client aid distribution that we have here in town. And it's just a wonderful volunteer opportunity. It's open to everyone. You don't have to be Catholic. We'll take anybody in. Mm-hmm. We don't care because everyone needs help.
You help anybody. You don't have to be Catholic to be helped.
That's right. That's correct. It doesn't make any difference what your religious beliefs are, your ethnic background. We don't care. If you are in need of help, you come to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, and we will do our best to put food on your table. We will try to put shelter over your head and clothe you if we can. It's a wonderful organization that helps those that are in need.
By the way, if you're planning to come and join us at Men Who Cook, hey, why don't you bring a can of soup or something just to help out, and we'll put it in the food bank, too. That would be a good idea. Speaking of the food bank, recently, John, last year, I think, you completed an addition to the food bank at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, an addition that was needed because you helped so many needy individuals and families. You needed more space.
That's correct, Dave. We put on an 1,800-square-foot addition to the food bank. Basically, it's a warehouse. And now we have the capability of buying our non-perishable food by the pallet, which is at a reduced cost. And we're able to get it in a timely manner. A lot of times now when it's on sale or, at a much decreased price, we're able to afford it. And then now we can stockpile it because we have the facility for it. Mm-hmm. We also have within that building a walk-in cooler that you can actually push a pallet of food in. It is 27 feet long, 7 feet high, and it is 11 feet deep, which was donated to us by Dr. Keelan from a building that he has just remodeled. It was the old McDonald's up on Newcastle Road. Mm-hmm. We went in and dismantled two different walk-in freezers, and we put them together, married them together, and made one large walk-in cooler. The cost, if we were to have bought a cooler of that size, would have been close to $35,000. The cost of this cooler was zero, mm-hmm, through gifts and grants from the people of Butler.
And that really helps because so many times in a food bank, well, it's the nature of the thing. So many of the things that are donated are non-perishable because you don't have space to keep them in the refrigerator for any length of time. You have at least some space for that now, right?
Oh, absolutely. Not only are we able to give non-perishable items, but now we get eggs from Walmart. So now we've got a place to store them. The fresh produce that we get from the different farmers in the area throughout the fall. The initiative Share Your Harvest program that was started by Jerry Motko and Lou Sizowitz, who were both Vincentians, that asked all the local gardeners, when you put your garden in, to put an extra plant or two in, and then that harvest would come to St. Vincent de Paul. So now we're able to bring all that fresh produce. It's not just canned goods that we're handing out to our clients, but now they're getting a total range of the food products that you need to eat healthy.
Can you explain a little bit how the food bank works? Are you open like certain days a week or certain hours, or how does that work?
Well, we are open certain hours, but and that is from 8:30 a.m. until 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to come once a month, and what we try to do is we try to give each family member three meals per day for 3 days. But believe me, whenever you walk out of the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, you have a shopping cart full of food. Again, canned goods, meat that has been donated to us by either Walmart, the Farm Show Livestock Auction that, through the FFA and the 4-H clubs, and then the Pennsylvania Hunters Association with venison.
Mm-hmm.
So you get, and we've got farmers that they give us bins of potatoes. We've got, I think there's three or four different potato farmers within the county that help us out tremendously. We've got farmers that plant rows of corn and fields of beans for us. So again, we get so much fresh produce. It's just wonderful. And the collaboration that we have with the different businesses in Butler and different individuals, we are very, very blessed. No one goes hungry when they come down to St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank.
Do you have any just ballpark figures on how many people you help, say, on average in a month or whatever?
Well, within a month, we average around 600 families that come in. We call them 600 clients, but it's families. From July of 2016 through December of 2016, these included 1,500 senior citizens, 4,700 adults, 2,600 children. And approximately 23% of those folks were disabled and 22% were veterans. Hmm. And each month we see on average 50 new clients. So we get 50 new clients, so we've got 50 others that may drop out or may go to a different food bank. They may go down to the Lighthouse or some other. Or,
well, maybe their situation has improved and they don't need
to. And that was the other angle. Maybe they've gone back to work and now they don't need our help.
The Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, by the way, and I should have mentioned this earlier. I guess I was kind of assuming everyone knows where it is. It's in the Lower Institute Hill area of the city of Butler. You can approach it on either North Monroe or North Elm Street, right?
Well, that's correct. The front door is at 157 Elm Street,
okay,
and it's been there for years. Our addition actually is on the Monroe Street, North Monroe Street side, directly across from Butler Catholic School Playground. Our office building, where Client 8 is located, is at 146 North Monroe Street. And there's a parking lot there, and then there's the back door into our warehouse area, the new building that was just built. Mm-hmm. You really can't miss it. It's the big building on Elm Street or North Monroe with a blue roof.
Yeah, not too many of those.
No,
and it's a huge building. I don't know what the building originally was. I'm not sure. It almost looks like it was a warehouse or even a barn-like structure.
Well, it was a grocery warehouse, and I can never remember the name, but I know Lou Sizowicz, who's our food bank manager, he knows the whole history of the building. He can remember going there when he was a kid. Hmm. But it was a grocery warehouse, and it is built very, very well. We've got four floors in the main building, from the basement up to the third floor. We see our clients, of course, on the first floor. We have storage in the basement with two walk-in coolers and a walk-in freezer in the basement. On the first floor of the old building, we have a walk-in cooler. We've got numerous other refrigeration units and freezers that we have that are almost constantly stocked. But that doesn't mean we don't need donations, because there's such a turnaround all the time. As quick as the food comes in, it's going back out again. Mm-hmm. So we always need to replenish our stock. And we are very fortunate through different civic groups within the community that do food drives, from Cub Scouts and the different schools, the churches. We are very, very blessed with the amount of food that we're able to obtain of no cost to the society.
I'm pleased to go over some of these statistics, because I think it's an eye-opener for a lot of our listeners. They don't realize just what a huge operation you are there at that food bank, and how many people and how many families you help on a regular basis. How do you have volunteers who help to, like, stock the shelves and distribute and stuff like that? How do you do all that?
Well, actually, everyone that works at the food bank is a volunteer. There are no paid employees at our food bank. Everyone gives of their time and of themselves. Some we have are, they're retired, like myself, I'm retired. There's a half a dozen or eight of us that we volunteer through the society. We also have another 10 or 12 that are client volunteers, and they come in and they volunteer their time. And of course, again, they only get food once a month, but still they're able to give back a little bit. Mm-hmm. We also have an initiative with the Davis Archway group, which is out in Herman. It's a halfway house for fellows that have gotten into problems with the law, and they have to do part of their return back into society is they have to do volunteer work.
Oh.
So we'll get anywhere from two to five or six fellows a week that'll come in. And it always changes because of the number of clients that the Davis Archway has. Big help. A lot of community service people come in. They need hours to pay back to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we put them to work.
Mm. Well, it's quite an operation. And that is really just part of the good that's done by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, the food bank. And I know John Gibson has worked in that a lot, but you also help out every once in a while driving the truck. I've seen you around town.
I do. Occasionally I'll do pickups. We call them, you know, the runs that we have to make in the morning. We go out to Walmart, Sam's Club, also the farm market, Red Lobster, Pizza Hut. Those are our big donors here within the city. But we're always looking for more volunteers. you know, we've got a few fellows that come in and they'll drive truck for us every day. And of course, you know, things happen in life and then they've got to take a day off like anybody else, and we need somebody to fill that time. So if you're thinking about you need something to do and you do have the time, please consider the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. We can use volunteer help at the food bank and also at our thrift store, which is located over at the Greater Butler Mart, which is at 226 Greater Butler Mart, right off Route 8 South.
Yeah, just south of the city. Yeah,
right.
And that's very convenient for people who want to drop off unwanted or unused items. It's free parking right next to the door, and very easy to do. Goodness gracious, folks, if you're you know, cleaning, spring cleaning coming up before too much longer, just general cleanup, you know, we're going to throw this stuff away. For goodness sakes, why put it in a landfill? Why not donate the items, whether it's clothing or furniture or whatever, to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul? They sell the items at the thrift store, and all of the proceeds stay here in Butler County, helping to fund the client aid and the food bank, which John was just talking about. Now, I understand that you're planning a big food drive coming up during... Is this during Lent? Is that when you're doing this?
Yes. We started a few years ago, and it actually started out at St. Wendelin's, and it was called 40 Cans for Lent. We had asked each parishioner if they would bring in one can of non-perishable food for each of the 40 days of Lent. This past Advent season, we went to Father Harry Billowitz for the city parishes and asked him if we could do the same thing for the 28 days of Advent, and he suggested that we go for four specific food items, which we did. They happened to be peanut butter, spaghetti sauce, soup, and fruit.
So you were asking people that came to church on Sunday to bring one of those things?
That's correct. Each week, they were asked to bring one item. The first week was peanut butter, and we collected over 700 jars of peanut butter. This is just the three city parishes. The second week were 700 jars of spaghetti sauce, over 2,000 cans of soup on the third week, and 1,500 cans of canned fruit for the fourth week. What that did, we didn't have to spend any money to buy those items. So far this year, we're looking maybe next month we'll have to. So, of course, with all that said, now we're almost into the Lent season. And we've got six different food items, actually five, and then the sixth week would be your choice. But we're looking for week one, canned tuna or salmon, week two, tuna helper, week three, hot or cold healthy cereal, week four, crackers, week five, macaroni and cheese, and then, of course, on the sixth week, anything that you would like to bring in would be gladly accepted. Again, the donations that we receive from our parishioners, from the public, from the different civic groups, the different businesses in town, I can't say enough about you folks for helping us help those that are in need. And as Pete Bertola used to say, we stand tallest when we stoop lowest.
Yeah, the late Pete Bertola. Another great volunteer for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. Something else that I just thought of, because this happened to me, I don't know, it was 3 or 4 years ago, I guess. There was a lady in our neighborhood who was downsized. Well, she's not only downsized, she was moving to a personal care home. Her husband had died, and she was elderly. And she had a lot of furniture and no use for it, really. And I suggested, call St. Vincent de Paul. She said, well, I'd never be able to get it down there. I said, they'll come and get it.
That's correct. And if you do have used furniture, please call our office on North Monroe Street. And the phone number is 724-287-3994. And extension 1 will put you in touch with Janet, and she sets up our furniture donation pickup times. And again, from the generosity of people in the Butler area, we're about 2 weeks out from the time that you call. So we get a lot of wonderful donations, and they're coming in all the time. But even with that, it still isn't enough to meet the need. The need's just ever increasing.
Goes out as fast as it comes in.
That's correct.
Well, in this case, this woman was... She was incredibly grateful. She didn't know what she was going to do. You know, it had a big dining room suite and a bunch of other stuff. And I mean, it was wonderful for her. And to say nothing of the good that it did, you know, somebody's using all that stuff now.
And the other thing is, it's a tax write-off if you'd like to use that for your income taxes. So it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul headquartered here in Butler now, the thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart and the food bank on North Monroe Street. Is that central headquarters for all of Butler County, or how does that work?
Yes. Our district council, the office is on North Monroe Street. Within the district council, we have 10 different conferences, 10 different parishes, and they encompass the majority of the county. I was elected president of the Butler District Council back in September. It's a 3-year term. I did not realize the extent of the job when I was asked to move into it. It is almost a full-time job. You've got full-time employees, you've got part-time employees, and you've got a lot of volunteers. And it's just, it's a lot of good stuff. It's really great. But again, our district council is headquartered here in Butler. We fall under the Pittsburgh Diocese, and the office for Pittsburgh is on Franklin Street over in the Manchester area of Pittsburgh.
So there are St. Vincent de Paul councils in all of our other parts of the country, too.
Worldwide. Correct. St. Vincent de Paul, the society was founded in Paris. Back in the 1700s, and then it came here to the United States. I know you'll correct me, and please if I'm wrong, but I believe it was St. Louis, and again, it was in the either late 1700s or early 1800s was the first conference of Society of St. Vincent de Paul, and it spread since then.
Makes sense that it would be St. Louis, because that was part of the Louisiana Territory before Thomas Jefferson bought it from the French. So, and St. Louis, of course, was named after Louis whatever, the 14th. So that makes sense that that's what would have started. I didn't realize it started in Paris.
Yeah. Yes, it did. Yeah, it's been around for a long time. The main function of Vincentian is the spirituality part of our life, and it's really directed at us individually, and then through our growth in spirituality, then God's love will shine through us to other people, and then we're able then to transfer that spirituality to those people that are in need.
People hearing you, John, and saying, you know, this might be good for me. Can they, stop down at the food bank? How can they get more information about becoming a volunteer for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul?
Well, it's very easy. Again, you can stop down at our food bank at 157 North Allen Street. If you wanted to stop over at the thrift store, 226 Greater Butler Mart, our office at 146 North Monroe Street. There's plenty of opportunities to volunteer. Please contact us. Please think of us. Again, it is a wonderful, wonderful vocation. You get much more back than what you give. It's a good thing.
And don't forget the food bank, or the food drive, to benefit the food bank, which will be starting. Lent is, I guess when comparing it to last year, Ash Wednesday last year was, I don't know, we had Christmas, it was a couple of weeks later, it was Lent already, because Easter was in March. Easter's much later this year, so Ash Wednesday is not, it's a couple of weeks away yet. Yeah. Food drive, you'll probably see these posters up around the area, certainly in churches. John Gibson is the president of the District Council of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul, one of the beneficiaries of our upcoming event, WISI's Men Who Cook Dinner Dance. Vicki Hinterberger is also here. And you, do you have any of the lineup of guys who are going to be there cooking and what they're going to be specializing in, Vicki?
Of course I do. And what we did was we invited these community leaders and we let them pick, Dave. I didn't say you need to do anything in particular. I let them pick. Mm-hmm. And County Commissioner Kevin Boozle is going to be preparing chicken Alfredo. Butler County Tourism Convention Bureau Director Jack Cohen is making chicken noodle soup. Our own Bob Cup is going to be making mashed potatoes. He's supposedly legendary for these. I've never had them, but on behalf of the couch potato who appears and makes cameo appearances during the football season, he's going to be making mashed potatoes. Pat Gallagher, who is a regular on WBUT, is making gullets, which is a French version of the pizzelle. So that's a dessert. John Paul from the Butler Transit Authority, who's a frequent guest on your show, is going to be making tomato tortellini soup, and he's texting me all the time telling me that he's going to be winning the Golden Fork because his soup is so fantastic.
Is this the People's Choice Award?
Yes.
After the sampling?
Exactly.
The Golden Fork.
The Golden Fork. Now, his contender, and I think this is a really serious contender, is Joe Taylor from Armstrong. Now, Joe last night was telling me about his Mardi Gras soup. All right. In addition, he has beads. You know how for Mardi Gras celebrations in anticipation of following Tuesday being Fat Tuesday, he's going to be decorating his booth in that theme and handing out Mardi Gras beads. I'm not perceiving it as bribery, but perhaps it will be perceived that way.
Mm-hmm. Vote for me, get beads. Okay, I got it.
In addition, State Representative Brian Ellis is going to be there, and he's going to be preparing an Italian pasta dish. Now, Brian was on your show last week, and Brian has so many options, he doesn't know what he's going to pick as far as the pasta dishes. He also is very, looking forward to this opportunity because he wants to prepare a show for the Food Network someday, grilling on the state capitals. He would like to grill on all the state capitals and have a zone.
We'll practice for him.
Exactly. Yeah. Then we also have Larry Sassone. Now, Larry Sassone is associated with the Butler Blue Sox. Any of you who know Larry know he's a character. Larry has asked me for two booths because he is bringing the sumo wrestlers and the emperor. And Larry took a long time to tell me what he was going to be making, but he is going to be preparing and serving Japanese-style goiza, stuffed chicken and cabbage, lightly seasoned with garlic, scallions, and ginger, served on a bed of jasmine rice. The dipping sauce is ginger and garlic-infused soy sauce blended with sesame oil and a rice wine vinegar. Do you think maybe The Butler Blue Sox Boosters Club will be out to hoist him into the championship for the Golden Fork.
And I'm thinking if the sumo wrestler, those are the guys from the
yes.
Kelly Automotive Park from the Blue yes. Sox games last year.
Yes.
If they're staring you down, that's going to be kind of intimidating to who you're going to vote for
exactly,
for the Golden Fork.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So,
sneaky.
It's going to be a lot of fun. We have Jim Thompson from Team Hardinger, who is also with the Butler AM Rotary Club, and I'm sure they'll be out to support him with his homemade stuffed manicotti with ground turkey to make it healthy, heart healthy, and some ricotta cheese and spinach.
Folks, for your ticket, $20, you get to sample all this stuff. It's
yes.
going to be made that night, and then after you do all the sampling, then you can kind of work off a little bit of your food by dancing for the next couple of hours.
Exactly.
Who else do we have? Oh, Hutch is going to be there.
Yes. Jack, you know
Hutchinson.
Hutch?
Oh, I know him very well, yes. We're both in the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
he is making Thanksgiving balls.
Seriously.
Really?
Not a laughing matter.
Okay. Thanksgiving balls. Have you ever had Thanksgiving balls,
I
Dave?
I have not, no.
Me neither, Dave, but I'm looking forward to it. He described it to me, and it will be interesting, and I think everybody should try to come out and taste those. Now, one of my other favorites, Sparky from PennDOT's coming. Sparky will be wearing his hard hat, and he's going to bring some fresh, infamous, sweet, roadkilly chili, okay, tying in with the PennDOT theme. In addition, we have Dave Crater from Friedman's. He'll be bringing pierogies, representative of the ethnic culture in our area. Dan Cunningham from the Rodfathers Club loves to cook and bake. Chicken parm and filled cupcakes, Dave. Sounds yummy.
So we got entrees, we got some desserts, we got soup and salad, we got the whole dinner here.
Exactly. We also have Tom Panay, the local artist, doing sushi, California rolls. We have one of our own, Jay McCain, doing cake ball cake shakes. Ryan Saylor, who is a news reporter, is always on the go. He's gonna serve the ever popular walking tacos. And then we have retired school superintendent Mike Panza, who's going to be making cheesecakes with toppings. So assorted toppings and assorted cheesecakes. Jim Oshie with the Butler Volunteer Township Volunteer Fire Department. Three different flavors of a comfort food we all love, gourmet mac and cheese.
Gourmet mac and
gourmet
cheese.
Gourmet mac and cheese was the term he used with me.
This is not just your basic craft.
No. So we have a lot of fun, and I would encourage the Butler listeners who would like to come out, get their tickets. I know Butler people like to procrastinate, but please get your tickets. We are limiting it to 300. So if anyone is interested, stop by our offices. They're $20. And join us for an evening of fun. We're also doing the basket auction, 50-50, and some other fun activities for those in attendance.
All to benefit the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank and the Heart Walk, sponsored by the American Heart Association, which for many years now has been taking place on the campus of Butler County Community College.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
And don't forget, bring a can of soup or something. Bring something for the food bank if you're coming. That would be nice, too. Have a little take home for the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. Week from this Saturday of next week, February 25th. Tickets $20. You can get them here at the radio station. And who's doing the Mardi Gras thing?
Joe Taylor from Armstrong, partner. Our partner in the
presentation. Because I just realized, because I was talking with John here a couple of minutes ago, Ash Wednesday, of course, is the beginning of Lent when the food drive will be starting. And so that weekend, not this weekend, but the next one, that's Mardi Gras weekend, because it's always technically Mardi Gras is Tuesday before Lent, but you know what, they do it in New Orleans and Rio de Janeiro and everything, that's the whole weekend. They're probably already starting to celebrate down there. So hope to see you there. It should be a lot of fun, and we'll be raising money for some good causes there. Thanks, gang. Thanks for being here. Good to talk with you, Vicki. John, good to see you.
Nice seeing you again, Dave.
More to come on It's Your Turn. Now, don't forget, a little bit later on the program today, not our next guest, but later on the program, we'll be talking with County Detective Mark Peffer. This will be the first in a series of programs we're doing over the next couple of days to deal with the opioid crisis, trying to give people a little bit more information on the opioid crisis that we're dealing with here in Butler County and have been dealing with for some time. We'll speak about the crisis from a law enforcement perspective with Mark a little bit later on the program. And by the way, along those lines tomorrow. We'll be chatting with President Judge Tom Durr, who will be here. We'll be looking at the opioid crisis from the criminal justice point of view, from the legal point of view. It's a crime, after all. People are sentenced if they're convicted. Also tomorrow, we'll be talking with getting the medical viewpoint of this problem, the opioid crisis. We'll be chatting with Robert Muntz of Butler Health System tomorrow. He'll be advising listeners on ways to assist an addict in getting help without enabling that person, without enabling them. So that's crucial. He'll be with us tomorrow, and we'll also talk with a recovering addict tomorrow. Jason will be with us. So four segments coming up over the next couple of days on the opioid crisis, all in advance of still another in the Opioid Education Forums being hosted by the county next week in Slippery Rock this time. Slippery Rock. Okay, take a break here for a couple of messages. When we come back, we're going to be talking about narcissism. Narcissism. A lot of folks think of it as bad. Our guest, Dr. Craig Malkin, said, well, yes, it is sometimes. But there are also some positive things, he says, about narcissism. Well, that's an interesting proposition. We'll talk about it with Craig Malkin. Coming up, just a couple of minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. We'll be right back.
If you're thinking about buying a car, truck, or SUV, or even if you just bought one, make sure you check out the great rates at Butler Armco Employees Credit Union. Through February 28th, you can get a 36-month loan on new and used vehicles for as low as 0.99% annual percentage rate. We'll even refinance your loan from another financial institution. It's never been easier to join, so call today or visit us at baecu.com for membership and rate information. Butler Armco Employees Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Listeners, a fascinating topic to discuss on the next segment of It's Your Turn. Nice to have you with us, by the way. Dave Malarkey is my name, and this is the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. We're going to be talking about narcissism on the next segment of the program. Yeah, narcissism. And don't worry if you're not quite sure what it is. We'll talk about that, too, with our guest. He is Dr. Craig Malkin, and he joins us by telephone today. Dr. Malkin, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to meet you, too, and hello, Pittsburgh, and I got to say hello to my brother Brian and his family who live in the Pittsburgh area.
We want to talk about narcissism today with Dr. Malkin because he's published a book, the title of which is Rethinking Narcissism, the Bad and Surprisingly Good Things About Feeling Special. Well, gosh, we'd better start, as I mentioned a minute or so ago there, Dr. Malkin, we better start by making sure that all of our listeners are on the same page and that they understand just what narcissism is. And I suppose we have to go back, I know you do in your book, back to the beginning, and that's back to Greek mythology, right?
Yeah. We need to talk about what it is and what it isn't, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will say, by way of introduction, if listeners want to get a taste of what the book is about, they can go to the narcissismtest.com and they can take a brief version of the research back test that I developed with colleagues. It's not the full test. You have to go get the book for the full test, but it does give research back tips and feedback. But when we think of narcissism, especially today, we traditionally have an image of the stereotypically vain, boastful reality TV types, chest-thumping braggarts, primping, preening people. That is our idea of narcissism, and it does go back to the Greek myth of Narcissus, a young man who fell in love with his own reflection and so became enamored with himself that he actually, two different versions, dove into the pool and disappeared forever, the mm-hmm. pool that he was looking into, and in another he just wastes away. The problem with this idea of narcissism being all about vanity and being loud and craving attention is that doesn't describe all types of narcissists. Some couldn't care less about fame or looks or money, and they might even be quiet. Hmm. So when people get focused on that, they aren't seeing the signs of trouble common to all narcissists. In rethinking narcissism, I redefine narcissism so that it includes all the different types, and I define narcissism simply as the drive to feel special. Hmm. And I do that because there's some other research we can get into that shows that a little bit of feeling special is healthy for us. But once you do that, when you think of narcissism as the drive to feel special, that is better than others, superior to them in some way, first of all, there are lots of ways to do that. There are narcissists who pride themselves on being the most misunderstood person in the room or the most helpful person in the world, and then you can spot that kind of trouble more easily. But the other thing it does is it allows you to recognize, okay, so what's a narcissist? A narcissist is someone who is addicted to feeling special, who sets all their considerations aside, including love, honor, truth, caring, connection, in order to feel special or better than other people.
Well, it's good that we talked about this initially because, the popular definition, the first thought that a lot of people have when you talk about narcissism is that it's a pejorative thought. It's seen as something bad, you know.
Yes, exactly. It's become a bit of an empty pejorative, in fact, because this is one of the reasons that we have this idea of millennials being the most narcissistic generation ever. And it confuses people terribly because what is clear from the research is that there are also healthy aspects to narcissism as it's measured. And researchers like myself and other colleagues, researchers who've put together a test, which the name of which I love, ours is called the Narcissism Spectrum Scale. Theirs is called the Narcissistic Admiration and Rivalry Questionnaire, which spells NARC. But we've begun to untangle these things, and it's actually really important because it turns out that all politicians, most politicians, I should say, it's overstating it. In the research, we know most politicians and almost all presidents are narcissists. The question is just how healthy. And you have to untangle the parts that are problematic from the parts that are actually helpful and that people benefit from. People high in healthy narcissism inspire instead of undermining people around them.
Well, it's good that we talked about this, but listeners, I suppose, this is fascinating. I hope you're intrigued already. We better tell you a little bit about our guest and why he knows of what he speaks. Dr. Craig Malkin is a clinical psychologist. He's an instructor of psychology for Harvard Medical School. His articles, advice on relationships have appeared in many magazines, Psychology Today, many others. He's been a featured commentator on NPR and Fox News, and as he just mentioned, on Huffington Post. So, indeed, he knows of what he speaks. One of the most interesting things that I found in your book, I have a review copy in front of me here, Dr. Malkin, is your discussion of the fact that you see narcissism as a scale, a spectrum. Now, we've become familiar with looking at, for example, autism on a spectrum. I've done a number of interviews with mental health professionals who see a variety of mental health afflictions on a spectrum. a scale. You say narcissism is the same thing, and that essentially everybody is on that scale somewhere.
Absolutely, yes. And there's always been an idea, I think we're going to find actually in mental health, that most traits, most things that that can become a diagnosable disorder lie along the spectrum. That understanding, I think, has been with us for a while in the field of psychology and psychiatry and mental health. I redefine the spectrum as you in rethinking narcissism. You know, I've talked about the first main rethink was we need to rethink the bad. I keep joking. I could have called the book The Surprising Bad and The Surprising Good, the subtitle, because, you know, when people get too distracted by that stereotypical vain boastful type, they can't see the other type. But as you know from reading it and rethinking narcissism, I redefine the spectrum because there's this other healthy piece. Over a quarter century of research shows, including our own research, that most people around the world feel a little special. They see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses. It's not a realistic self-view. And that helps them feel more optimistic and resilient and persist in the face of failure, even enjoy big dreams. And what's left out, the problem in the current research, is there's this giant hole where no one talks about the difficulty of people who lack that. Going back to the myth of Narcissus had many people fall in love with him. One was a nymph named Echo.
Mm-hmm.
That is the myth of Narcissus and Echo. And Echo was cursed to repeat back only the last few words she could hear. She had no voice of her own. And what we've understood and seen in the research is that people who lack the ability to see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, who have that generous view of themselves, they tend to live their life by the rule, the less room I take up, the better. They can be very caring and empathic. And other therapists out there will know exactly what I'm talking about, and maybe some listeners have been through it. They tend to wind up people I've dubbed this echoism, this problem. They tend to wind up with extremely narcissistic friends and partners. So the surprising good is the empowerment. How can you develop a voice that helps you not just spot trouble, but cope and extract yourself from difficult relationships?
Fascinating stuff. Listeners, we have a few more minutes that we're able to chat with Dr. Craig Malkin. Again, the title of his book is Rethinking Narcissism. And we'll pick up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening, every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Welcome back, listeners. It's Your Turn program here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest visits with us by telephone. He is author and clinical psychologist, Dr. Craig Malkin. We're talking about his book, Rethinking Narcissism. By the way, if you're looking for Dr. Malkin, his last name is spelled M-A-L-K-I-N. And I'm going to have him repeat a website here in just a moment or so, because that's what I'd like to pick up our conversation talking about. It's the tool that you use, the diagnostic tool that you use in your clinical work and in your research. You call it the narcissism test.
Correct. Yeah, that's the brief version online. Again, there's a longer version in the book that actually helps people locate them on the spectrum. And just to circle back to the rethink that I've done, most spectrums of narcissism that have been proposed, they start at bad and then they get more bad. But the problem is there's been this understanding and evidence for the longest time of healthy narcissism, of people who see themselves through slightly rose-colored glasses, people who score high on parts of the of different narcissism tests where they will answer questions like, I am assertive, with yes. Not surprisingly, that's correlated with all kinds of great stuff. But there's been no place to put the health. So what I did was I reshaped it where health is in the middle, a lack of healthiness, narcissism is at the far left, and at the top right we have extreme narcissism and up to NPD. I want to clarify that narcissist is not a diagnosis. It means someone higher in traits of narcissism or who scores above average, well above average on tests of narcissism compared to average people. They may or may not be disordered. Hence my statement earlier, because that in the research we see most politicians and many presidents are narcissists. They may just have more of the healthy piece than the unhealthy piece. Mm-hmm. The test helps people get a rough sense of where they are. If you go to the narcissismtest.com, the brief test, it's only 9 questions, will give you a rough sense of where you are. Do you struggle with echoism? Do you struggle with extreme narcissism? Are you right in the healthy area of the spectrum? And what can you do if you're struggling at either extreme? And that's where when you take it, you get the research back tips and feedback where we put together this test. And at this point, probably over 2,000 people took it in our studies to validate the measure, many all over the world. At this point, I haven't checked in a while, but close to 50,000 people have taken the brief version that's online.
Mm-hmm. I find this fascinating. I'm sure many of our listeners do, too. You know, I'm thinking as we chat about some of the people I know, where am I going to put them in my own judgment
exactly.
On the scale, on the spectrum? Where am I going to put myself? I'm going to take the test. Do we know anything, Dr. Craig Malkin, our guest, do we know anything about the cause of either narcissism or echoism? And do you talk about that in your book?
I absolutely do. We do know a lot about it. In Rethinking Narcissism, I go over much of the research. And what's clear, we can start with extreme narcissism. Narcissistic personality disorder, you want to think of almost like an extreme addiction, that people are so uncomfortable turning to others and depending on them to get their needs met that they use feeling special like a drug to soothe themselves, and they use it every time over anything else. They would lie, steal, cheat, do whatever it takes to get their high that comes from feeling special. So how does that happen? There was a 20-year longitudinal study, fascinating, done by a psychologist researcher named Phoebe Kramer, and she followed people from preschool all the way up to early adulthood. And she saw signs of early precursors for unhealthy narcissism, kids who were always showing off, they were impulsive, they were rule breakers. And what's interesting is when she followed them over time, she found that some of them grew up to become extremely narcissistic, very unhealthy. But the children whose parents taught them how to talk about their feelings, who left them with the sense that they could depend, that they could turn to others when they were feeling lonely or sad or scared and expect to be understood and heard and to be able to depend on the others that they love, something called secure attachment, that when those children had secure attachment, they did not become unhealthy narcissists. They did not grow up to become narcissists. In our research, we found, so you can think of being a narcissist as a way of coping with that particular insecurity. I'm not going to bother to try to depend on anyone. I'm going to do everything I can, whether it's to work on my looks or my money or whatever, in order to feel superior, and that's going to make me feel good. People who struggle with echoism, also worry about whether or not they can depend on others, but they have almost the exact opposite approach. Usually they've been raised by extremely narcissistic parents, where it's sort of come to feel dangerous for them to turn to others and ask for any kind of special attention or even expect to be celebrated in their accomplishments. Often their narcissistic parents need to take up all the room. So they sort of learn the stance in life of the less room I take up, the better. And if I have as little impact as possible, maybe people will stay connected with me, and maybe they'll like me, maybe they'll love me. So it comes from the same place of not being sure they can depend on people for important needs and caring and comfort, but they handle it instead by trying to basically make themselves smaller in relationships.
You, and I'm sure you won't mind me mentioning this because you talk about your mom in the introduction to your book. You say she was wonderful. She was also infuriating at times. She was a narcissist, but you talk about how at a particular time in her life, later in her life, when she used this as, you realized she was using it as a crutch.
Yeah, and she was definitely, as she became older, she was a striking woman, nearly 6 foot tall, blonde, and she got a lot of attention for that. Her own childhood was fairly miserable, and so this became her sole means of feeling good about herself, that people really noticed her. But as she got older and her looks started to fade, that became something she could rely on less. Remember, narcissists tend to find ways of feeling special. And it just grew much worse. She became way more self-involved and interrupted everyone, and she couldn't listen, and everything sort of always came back to her, and she could also be very insulting and critical. What drew me to the field of studying narcissism in the first place was trying to understand all of that, trying to understand how to relate with her, if I could at all, and really trying to help my clients who struggled with similar relationships. But really, there was the whole puzzle of how did this get so bad? I saw, and how do we relate these things where you can see all this good, and then there were certainly problems, but what happened that she transformed in this way that was much harder to be around when I got older and when she got older? And that was one of the things I wanted to help people understand.
Dr. Craig Malkin is a clinical psychologist. Do people seek treatment for narcissism?
Well, in Rethinking Narcissism, the other thing that I do is I lay out in the spectrum subtler versions. Again, remember, if you're looking for the obvious types, you're not going to see all the trouble. Really, this subtly comes out precisely because people who struggle with narcissism give themselves away with their inability to feel comfortable depending on others by saying, I'm feeling sad or scared or lonely, and expecting people to be there for them. Some have that capacity. Even if they have narcissistic personality disorder, some are able to at least admit they have a problem. Those are the types who are apt to come in for treatment and even stay in treatment. So when you're talking about extreme disorder, which is about 1% of the population around the world who has narcissistic personality disorder, which is marked by extreme exploitation of others usually, and entitlement and an empathy, impairment in empathy, it's a long, hard road for them to recover. But the ones who are committed to recognizing that there's a problem here, and I've seen many of them over the years, there is hope for them. And in Rethinking Narcissism, I provide a much clearer path for what they need to focus on. And that is starting to be more comfortable with these more vulnerable feelings and turning to people with them. That's really the cure.
Our time runs short, to listeners, and do remember, and this is in the subtitle of Dr. Malkin's book, the bad and the good of narcissism. There's much more in the book. We obviously, due to time restraints, we can't talk about, but talking about dealing with the lovers and family and friends and all sorts of other fascinating chapters. And, of course, the full test, narcissism test is in the book as well. The title is Rethinking Narcissism, the Bad and Surprising Good About Feeling Special, by our guest for the past few minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISR, Dr. Craig Malkin. Nice to meet you. Nice to talk with you, Doctor.
Oh, my pleasure speaking with you, Dave. I hope everybody finds the book helpful, and I hope they check out the test, because a lot of people have found it a good start in understanding this.
Yeah, if you want to take a quick look at it, folks, it's online at thenarcissismtest.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus,
we're going your way. Getting there stops here. Just hop the bus, easy and economical. Just hop the bus, no car, no problem, the bus will get you there. Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus,
we're going your way.
Welcome back, folks. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program. And for our final segment today, we actually are beginning now four straight segments of It's Your Turn over the next, from now through tomorrow, where we are going to be looking at the opioid crisis here in our community. When I say our community, Butler and surrounding areas, from a variety of different standpoints. On tomorrow's program, our guests will include the president judge of Butler County, Tom Durr. We'll be obviously looking at the crisis from the aspect of the court system. It's illegal, after all, for most of these drugs. We'll talk with Judge Durr. Also tomorrow we'll have a guest with us from Butler Health System. He is Robert Muntz. He'll be discussing ways that we can assist addicts in getting help without enabling them. Sometimes people make the mistake, you know, that they're trying to be helpful and they end up causing more harm than good. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. And also tomorrow we are scheduled to talk with a recovering addict. His name is Jason Beckwith, so he'll be with us tomorrow as well. Today, though, we welcome Mark Peffer to our studios. He is chief deputy in the Sheriff's Department under Sheriff Mike Sloop. And, gosh, Mark, good to see you. It's been a long time since you and I shook hands.
It's been a little while, but it's great to be here this afternoon, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Good to see a familiar face, too. We were kind of chatting in a couple of minutes we had there before we went on the air. Mark and I go back quite a ways.
Absolutely.
Back when you were a city police officer here in the city of Butler.
Yes, sir. It's we have both seen the times and how they've changed, and it's good to be acquainted with you throughout it all.
Well, I mention it because you having a long career now in law enforcement as a law enforcement officer, the change is definite. I mean, we had drugs 20 years ago.
Sure.
25 years ago. But we didn't have drugs like we have now. We didn't have this opioid crisis that we have now.
That's for sure.
I mean,
it
was marijuana and cocaine mainly back then, right?
Yeah, and even the main, you know, factor that we dealt with was alcohol. I mean, that was a consistent thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, working for the city police, we made regular arrests on that. And sure, you come across marijuana. And in the 90s, early 90s, with cocaine, crack cocaine specifically, when it impacted our region, and we felt the blow of that and dealt with that through the drug task force that was created then through the Attorney General's office. But yes, you're right, Dave. It's a different animal today with the opioid and opiate addiction and the deaths and results we're seeing from that for sure.
Yeah. And in many cases, not all, but in many cases, people, from what I've interviewed people and read about this, they get addicted coming off painkillers. Sometimes they have back surgery or knee replacement, any kind of serious surgery, and they are prescribed opioids because they are powerful painkillers.
Right.
And they get hooked on them.
That's the scary end of it. They may be not on a criminal path, so to speak, leading up to this. It can be the person next door. It can be somebody within your family. It can be you.
Mm-hmm.
And it can sneak up on you, so to speak. There's a different avenue to become, quote unquote, an addict to opioids that we haven't really realized before. Instead of behaviorally building up to it, you can find yourself in that scenario unexpectedly.
And these pills, OxyContin, some of these really high-profile painkillers, Vicodin, and so on, they are they're opioids, just like heroin.
It's synthetically created, yes.
Yeah.
Just the same effects.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I know myself, I've had some minor medical procedures done in my life and been prescribed those medications, and mm-hmm. I've chosen not to fulfill them. I mean, they were available to me, and I was even shocked then. I have a whole month's supply of this very potent painkiller mm-hmm. that it turned out I really didn't need, but that was my circumstance. There are people that need those drastic painkillers. I get that. But if they're misused, abused, even accidentally, boy, oh, boy, it can be a deep hole you dig for yourself.
And as I understand it, many people do get hooked on these things. The initial prescription runs out. Maybe they can get it refilled once or even twice. But eventually, you know, the physician is not going to refill it. And that's when they turn to heroin as their substitute. Number one, it's available. I can't get the pills anymore. And number two, I guess it's relatively cheap. I have no idea. I know... that law enforcement people deal with the so-called stamp bags of heroin, small little, like, wax paper bags.
Yes.
Is that how it's sold, by the bag? Or
that's the most common method it's delivered in, yes. That's the most common street way of requiring it, either through individual bags, but usually sold in bricks or bundles in larger quantities. But, yeah, you're talking $7, $10 per bag, depending on your the quantity. That's a lot less expensive than an OxyContin pill, so to speak, at a street level, mm-hmm. especially if you don't have the insurance coverage and you still have the pain. So sometimes, ultimately, you do turn to this. But you can overdose on the medication itself. That can cause the same outcome. But yes, if you do end up turning to the street-level drug of heroin, and the trouble is it's not FDA-approved or regulated. Mm-hmm. So what are you getting in that bag? And we've all read about the carfentanil, methylfentanyl, and different derivatives thereof that sometimes mixed in to change the potency of the heroin itself. It's rolling the dice. The bottom line is, when you're at that level, what we have got to view this is as poison. You are purchasing a poison, not something that's going to make you feel better or medicate you. We've all got to start realizing this is poison you're placing into your body. And unfortunately, we read about the deaths regularly, the outcomes of this.
This carfentanil, it's an elephant tranquilizer, for goodness sakes. I first read about it last year, and it's now spread from Cleveland into Beaver County, Butler County. We have it here locally. And this is so deadly now that even within the past couple of months, directives have been issued to first responders, ambulance personnel, police officers, firefighters, anybody who might be even administering the Narcan overdose reversal drug. I guess this stuff can be absorbed through the skin. You can breathe it in, and you can die.
Yes, we've taken some policy changes within the sheriff's office called universal precautions, gloves, mm-hmm. masks, a response to those things if you recognize the problem, to protect others and yourself. Yes, it can be absorbed. But one thing we want to, carfentanil is a huge problem. And even this morning I heard that in China, where it was a non-controlled substance, it could be purchased quite easily. As of now, they're considering it a controlled substance. So over in China, a big source of it, they're starting to regulate it more tightly. And that's great. That's a step. However, how much is already in existence between here and China? And what's on the street, you still don't know. I don't want anybody to be fooled thinking, well, now the streets are safer because China regulates their carfentanil a little better. And in addition to this, too, 74 people within our community here in Butler lost their lives due to overdoses with drugs. One of them was confirmed to have a carfentanil component within it.
This is last year, not?
Last year, 2016.
74 deaths, wow.
So 73 others had a mixture of heroin, opioids, and other drugs that ended their life, too. So carfentanil is a horrible drug to place in your body. Yes, it is an elephant tranquilizer, incredibly potent, but there is no safe alternative to that when you're going to the streets to try to, you know, feed your addiction. There's just no safe avenue for that.
From a law enforcement standpoint, by the way, folks, if you're joining us a little bit late on this segment of It's Your Turn, welcome. Mark Peffer is our guest. He is the Chief Deputy Sheriff here in Butler County to Sheriff Mike Sloop. from a law enforcement standpoint, and I don't want you to talk about anything that you shouldn't be talking about in terms of what law enforcement people have to do to catch these bad guys and so on and so forth. But where does this stuff come from? How does it come into Butler County? I mean, obviously we don't grow poppies here, so the opioids they're not homegrown. They've got to come in here from somewhere, and somehow, generally by car, by vehicle, they're driven in from somewhere?
Oh, sure. And the thing of it is, I mean, it's a powder form, and so it's so easy to conceal, so easy to transport, so easy to hide from others. There's a multitude of different ways. If there was one main avenue, it'd be a lot easier to shut down. But, you know, obviously from the south through, you know, the Mexican border is one source, but that certainly isn't the only one. The Canadian border is another one coming from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's here within the country, how it can be processed, you know, cut, so to speak, added to endless number of steps before is actually sold to somebody in our community. It's almost impossible to tell the entire lineage of where that substance came from. But
the classic scenario that we see on TV and in the movies, where there's a, you know, a kingpin and then some lower echelon people and then street dealers. Is that really true? Is that the way it works?
To a point, yes. To a point, obviously. I mean, we have some folks from out of our community coming here from either, you know, on the eastern side of the state or from, you know, Detroit for Youngstown, or there's a multitude of different areas, but driving here to sell their product, you know, maybe being here on a temporary basis, selling to people within our community, collecting the cash for it, and then going back and, you know, reestablishing a new supply and coming back. And what that is driven by, though, is a supply and demand. The customers are here. There are many other locations, too. Butler is not a king selling point in the state, but it is one of many that we have to recognize, and that's what we are responsible for. We are responsible for Butler City, Butler County, Butler's communities, and that's what we get to concentrate on. So yes, you do find these things out, and the Drug Task Force, our Attorney General's office, the District Attorney's office are very vigilant, keeping a track of, you know, some basic lines that they can enforce as far as maybe where other communities are involved in this, whether states' law enforcement agencies working tightly with them. But when it's here and you can make the arrest on it for delivering this poison, they make the arrest. The arrest is made.
Does a police officer have to witness a drug deal to make an arrest?
No. No, it can come through an investigation, through confidential informants, through search warrants, what you find within a house, within a car, within a person's pocket. You know, you don't have to witness the actual transaction. It can be part of an investigation, but certainly not the only one.
Could start it, for example, but or you could get reports from somebody.
Absolutely. And we really appreciate it when the community gets involved.
Unusual activity. There's people going in and out of this house at all hours of the night.
Yes, license plate numbers can be helpful. They can tie in with other investigations. Things are already on file. We strongly encourage not any direct interaction to stop this suspected activity, but anything you can report to your local law enforcement agency is helpful. You'd be surprised how many things can tie together behind the scenes that don't always make it into the final report, but it can really help establish probable cause and get an investigation underway.
Mm-hmm. The bad guys, and I use that term loosely, bad guys, do they do stuff like, try to obscure their license plate number when they're in town doing business or something like that?
I suppose on occasion it can happen. Sometimes they'll borrow cars, rent cars, or else just get a ride into the community, set up shop, so to speak, in an apartment or a home, sell the product, and then leave by other means. Let's face it, they can be very innovative. These aren't just people with no mind or brain or decision-making capabilities to come in and do this. They can be very crafty about their business sense, and it's always, you know, we try to stay one step ahead of them, but it's sometimes hard to do.
You have little time for people that come into our county to profit from this epidemic. You say no excuse, no mercy for that.
I am one of many that say that, for sure. Those that are simply here to make money off of this, sell the product, absolutely. And I know our district attorney, the AG's office, the officers on the street feel the same way. When an arrest is applicable, they make the arrest and prosecution happens. The other end of the spectrum is those that are being victimized by this, that are taking in it as addicts. The attitudes of law enforcement and our prosecution of that is changing somewhat. We are viewing them more as victims to the proper point. You know, it's not always just a scot-free situation, but certain laws have changed. There's an Act 139, which does assist in gaining immunity if they are experiencing an overdose. Let's say they've ingested it, or they're with somebody that has taken an opioid and they're overdosing, and they call in for help.
Mm-hmm.
They can be immune. They are immune from prosecution in a vast number of circumstances. If there's still paraphernalia or some of the drug substance still there, they're not going to be charged for that specifically if they're honestly seeking out help for somebody that could be dying from it. Or if they themselves, they think, oh my goodness, I'm going into a point where I could be dead, and they're calling for help, they're not going to get charged for that. They are encouraged to seek that help, basically to stay alive. That's the goal.
So police officers are looking at this perhaps a little bit differently now as this whole thing evolves. And really, it's in the past several years that it's evolved to the point where,
sure.
I mean, if you had said opioid crisis 5 years ago, people would have said, what are you talking about? You know, we now have government officials involved at higher levels. The state officials are involved. Governor Tom Wolf convened a special summit last fall, September, October, I forget just exactly when, but called the state lawmakers back into session to deal directly with this. And there were some things that came out of that. New guidelines for doctors in terms of prescribing these opioids.
Sure
let's,
thing.
Let's not do it so readily. Let's not prescribe so many of them, so on and so forth.
Absolutely. And those are super positive steps. Mm-hmm. The actual administration prescribing of the opioid-based medications was much limited now from what it was before. And that's a big step, not having it in somebody's possession or in their house, getting it on a shorter-term basis, and then seeing how they're doing with it, monitoring that more closely. And then the other aspect of it is if they do find that there's an addictive situation underway and they are caught in that, trying to have that warm handoff is what it's being phrased as, from being found with that addictive personality or having that problem underway in their life that they maybe have overdosed or have sought treatment or even got arrested, and then trying to get them more quickly into a treatment program. While the situation is still very fresh to them, that they can seek treatment more readily.
So this is it's a fine line for law enforcement officers to walk, but it's good that they're looking at this from, you focus on accountability on the one side. Okay, this is wrong. It's against the law.
Sure.
But empathy at the same time, because many times these people. For lack of a better phrase, they can't help themselves.
That's true. I mean, and you realize that when it hits home, when it's somebody you're better acquainted with or somebody within your own family. And unfortunately, more and more of us can say that we know somebody, or maybe ourselves have been affected by this more directly. That's when it starts hitting home, and you realize that, and our district attorney has quoted this phrase, we cannot arrest our way out of this problem. If it was that simple, we'd just have the criminal complaints ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't work. Somebody can be arrested in through an incarceration period and come back out and then pick up right where they left off with their addiction. That's when overdoses can oftentimes happen. The body's not yet accustomed to that. The treatment angle is being emphasized now more than ever. Saving the lives in the street or in people's homes, with the use of Narcan and Naloxone is increased drastically. Just before I came down here, it was starting around 12:30 when I was leaving the office, I heard two different calls on the way in here for overdose situations. So this is active, and that's just this afternoon. So we've got to recognize that just filing charges isn't going to stop that. We've got to find a better way to break this cycle.
So first, let's keep these people alive, and
right.
Let's see if we can break the cycle.
Right.
Get them to realize what they're doing and get them to treatment. And they have to, I guess it's kind of like, people wanting to break the nicotine habit. I want to stop smoking or whatever. You have to want to do it. I mean, you can lay out all the facts to people. You can give them charts and graphs and videos and everything else, but they've got to want to do it.
They have to want to do it. But we as a community also have to realize that once a person starts abusing an opioid or an opiate-based product, legal or otherwise, it actually changes the chemistry of the brain. It actually changes the way person initially started to think about things to their new attitudes using the drug. The transmitters and receptors of the mind that are affected by the opioids actually modify themselves around the addiction. It reinforces the addiction. It causes the addiction. So when one dose of an opioid works today, a few weeks or 2 weeks later, you need a lot more to have that same effect. And it's a spiral effect. It's a downhill battle. And but the brain chemistry is affected, and it takes a long time after it's stopped of usage. I mean, when it probably ceases from the use, for the mind to start healing itself, to coming back on the right track. It can take a long time, 1 to 3 years, some people say. But taking that first step to not use is a big thing. You can want it, you can realize it's wrong, but you have to keep in mind about the chemistry of the brain is actually altered too.
Is this one of the big things that law enforcement officers are facing today? Would you? Certainly going to be one of the top two or three issues for law enforcement.
Absolutely. It's not just even the overdose calls themselves or the drug investigations themselves, but then the peripheral crimes, the thefts, the domestic situations in homes that are affected, you know, upsetting the family lives, mm-hmm. The driving offenses, you know, people crashing their cars or stealing cars. Or there's an endless amount of different peripheral crimes that are, you know, related to this or incidents that officers have to respond to.
The thefts, of course, to get money to buy the drugs, stealing from even as simple as breaking into cars to get coins out of the center console. I mean, that's how desperate these people are.
That's just it, and it's hard for us to realize if we're not addicts ourselves to maybe relate to how desperate a person can feel in those circumstances. I mean, we can all relate, like, boy, I missed supper today. I'm really, really hungry, and I desire a meal. But this is something more hardwired in somebody's thought process when the addiction is underway, and it's less and less of a choice. It's something that they feel the need to do, the requirement in their life to do, and they do these desperate things that they wouldn't have done otherwise.
It's great for me, and listeners, I hope you're hearing the same things that I'm hearing. Law enforcement and the person here of Mark Peffer, Chief Deputy Sheriff for Butler County, law enforcement obviously has had educational programs, has had training, continuing education to get a real handle on this. So it's not just lock them up, really trying to get a handle on this. We need to take a break. We'll talk a little bit more with Mark in just a couple of minutes here on It's Your Turn on WISO. We need to check lottery numbers. We've got them in from Harrisburg. We'll do that, and we'll be back in just a moment or so.
Midday lottery numbers for today. The pick 2 is 8787. The pick 3 is 516. The pick 4 is 1461. The pick 5 is 89026. The wild ball for each of those is 0. The treasure hunt, 19, 20, 25, 27, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000. Lottery numbers brought to you by New Haven Court at Clearview.
Moving from my home of 50 years was a little scary, but I wasn't safe at home anymore, and my daughter with her busy life, children and grandchildren, it wasn't fair for me to expect so much from her.
We looked together to find a new home and discovered New Haven Court at Clearview.
What made the difference were the employees and the residents we met. The residents said it was a great place to live.
New Haven Court at Clearview, a great place to live because it's a great place to work. 888-261-5753 or visit IntegraCare.com.
Welcome back, folks. We're chatting, and it's a pleasure to have him here. Mark Peffer is Chief Deputy Sheriff for Butler County in the office of Sheriff Mike Sloop. We're talking about the opioid crisis from a law enforcement perspective. Do the deputies in the sheriff's office, do you deal directly with this at any time, or are you of aid to other police departments in these areas? Because the responsibilities of the sheriff's office are mainly to do with the court system, right?
That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. But we do see the effects of it by those we transport, those we deal with in the court system, in front of our judges, in the probation office, of course. So we see the side effects of that, how it actually is affecting a person's life through conviction or through they actually have the treatment courts now, you know, with the treatments mm-hmm. that are being brought forth legally, which is a fantastic step that our county has led with. But we do assist, though. We do assist police departments, the state police, the AG's office, when asked to or when we become aware of an incident that we can assist with in any way, of course. To free up the investigators, maybe doing undercover work or the more in-depth investigations, or in any other way that we can assist in streamlining the process.
The state has made money available for some years now to help fund the district attorney's drug task force.
Yes.
District Attorney Rich Goldinger has a drug task force now. The state grant money helps to pay the overtime costs of getting police officers to serve on that drug task force because it's made up of police officers from various municipalities who are working over. That's what they're doing. In addition to their regular shift, their regular duties. Do any of the sheriff's deputies ever serve on that?
We're called in to assist on those. Now, the way the law is currently drafted, we cannot be funded directly by the AG's office on that. It's a great concept. We totally support it. Mm-hmm. It's just a legal aspect of it that the deputy sheriff statewide cannot serve directly on that. But we're so happy when our district attorney or the attorney general's office or the drug task force says, can you help? And the sheriff has been fantastic about jumping on board to help out, usually with either securing an area, transporting individuals after an arrest. It keeps the other officers available to keep running with the investigation that way. So
there are little things that some of us, I guess, don't realize the police are looking for. We had a story just within the past couple of weeks in the news where I think it was two state police officers pulled over a motorist on Route 28. The key, the thing that clued them in was the license plate lights were burned out. So the license plate wasn't illuminated at night. And it turned out to be a guy who was driving under the influence and had drugs in the car. Drug paraphernalia. I'm interested if there's been any scuttlebutt among law enforcement. You know, just within the past few months, we've eliminated the registration sticker on license plates. State officials say that's going to save us, $3 million.
Right.
I'm not sure how, I don't know how it could be that much, but anyway, that's what they say. It seems to me that would be a, you know, they keep saying, oh, well, police can, you know, they can instantly run the numbers and determine whether it's, you know, the person has paid their registration fee. Like a lot of extra work for me. What's the scuttlebutt among police officers?
Well, I hate to be a spokesman for the law enforcement community overall, but I've heard very little positive in the way of that change.
I can't imagine there would be very little positive. Yeah. I mean, what the big deal? It's a little. I don't remember myself getting a new license plate in the mail every year, but I can remember when my dad did.
I remember
when I was
that
a little kid.
Sure.
You got a new license plate every year.
Right.
Came in the mail.
Right.
And then we graduated to getting a little sticker that you put on your license plate for, I think I had one license plate with 12 or 13 of them on there. Now there's nothing.
Right.
Now there's nothing.
And it's those little things, too. Like you said, sometimes people just forget to put the sticker on, and that, or in the past anyways, and you could check it out and find out it was a properly registered vehicle or properly inspected or that minor, quote-unquote, traffic offense that you can handle appropriately. But, yes, there are those cases where you're stopping somebody to check out even something as small as a burned out light, and it evolves into something quite a bit more serious. So as you were mentioning, Dave, you know, in that case, somebody was transporting drugs. Where were those drugs going to wind up? You know, what was going to be the next avenue for those to affect somebody's life? Mm-hmm. So even something small like that can really add up, and a good professional law enforcement officer is going to pick up on that, and we'll take the appropriate action. So
what about there's been a movement to eliminate an automatic prison sentence for first offenders for a small amount of marijuana. I have mixed feelings on that. I have no law enforcement experience and certainly no training or education in that area. I can go back and forth. I can understand that simply throwing somebody in jail, especially without any treatment options while they're incarcerated, and then come back out on the street, I mean, that's just... And you're asking for them to go right back to, you know, to using drugs.
Sure.
And maybe in the long run, it's financially makes better sense to mandate some sort of a treatment program instead of going to jail. But I don't know what police officers think about that.
Well, police officers especially, but a lot of first responders, I think, would back me up on this. No matter what any group out there may say, there are still definite gateway drugs that can lead them. We were talking about the abuse of pain medication that can lead to an opioid addiction. We cannot ever forget, though, the younger generation, if they experiment with alcohol under 21, if they're experimenting with the quote-unquote lesser, you know, controlled substances like marijuana, okay, it can still absolutely lead to addictions, with the example here being opioids. It can definitely get you there. I don't ever want to downplay that, because we've seen it happen as professionals too many times. That path being laid out, the wrong choices being made, and it winds up with an addiction that's just as hard to beat as anything else. So we never want to discount that, of course. But the reality of it is, if somebody is charged with a small amount of marijuana right now, the chance of them really serving a sentence, I mean, it's a misdemeanor offense. So it's usually more of a supervising, probation-based, fine-based, license-suspending-based sentence. Here again, trying to steer them away from those choices, you know, to choose some other, you know, more healthy behavior. Because no matter what they say, marijuana still is very harmful. And it can be behaviorally addictive as opposed to maybe being chemically addictive, but addictive nonetheless.
And I think my absolutely amateur opinion would be there's a certain thing here, in my mind at least, where you cross a threshold, you know.
Right.
You know that it's against the law, okay, so it's a misdemeanor, but once you step across that threshold,